of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, March 11th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
A live report from Saudi Arabia on the Day of Rage. Michigan passes a far-reaching bill on emergency financial managers. Plus, the movement against the death penalty makes gains with Illinois' ban. And this week's Rethink Reviews with Jonathan Kim.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Thousands of Saudi activists were expected to gather today for what activists have dubbed a day of rage. A week of protests leading up to today had smaller than expected crowds. There has been a call for two demonstrations this month announced on Facebook, the first of which was to have taken place today across the country. However, there are reports of protests taking place only in the eastern province city of Qatif, where police apparently opened fire on protesters. Shiites form a large part of the Saudi dissident groups. They want the release of what are considered political prisoners. Protesters also want King Abdullah to hold elections, since there's never been a parliament or elected body in Saudi Arabia. According to Reuters, the activists comprise, quote, a loose alliance of liberals, moderate Islamists, and Shiites. Shiite citizens complain of discrimination by the Sunni monarchy and may have been inspired by recent protests by Shiites in neighboring Bahrain. Last November, Human Rights Watch reported that a Saudi journalist who wrote about public anger over frequent electricity cuts was sentenced to 2 months in prison and 50 lashes. To attempt to quell the unrest, the Saudi king returned from a three-month trip and announced $37 billion in new public services and benefits. His regime has been clearly rattled by events happening all over the Arab world. And in response to the Egypt revolution, he accused protesters of, quote, spewing hatred and of being infiltrators. Last Saturday, the Saudi Interior Ministry grimly reminded the population of a ban on protests in the country and warned that the ban would now be enforced. Last year, President Obama announced an arms deal with Saudi Arabia worth $60 billion. It was the largest U.S. arms deal in history. Together with the U.S., the Saudi regime has offered backing to many of the region's strongmen. We go now live to Saudi Arabia to join Ahmed Al-Mulla, who is a writer and poet based there. He's in Qatif, where police fired on protesters yesterday. Welcome to Uprising, Ahmed.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, first tell us what exactly happened in Qatif. You are there right now, and that's the only place that we're getting reports from here where police apparently fired on protesters. How many people showed up to protest, and was anybody hurt or killed?
For today, nobody hurt here in Qatif, but protesters more than yesterday and the days before. It was in Qatif, the city, more than 500 or 600, around 500 to 600 men and women, and also in the towns around Qatif, there are more than four demonstrations, and also all of them start at 4 o'clock afternoon and finish at 6:30. And it was surrounded by the force and the helicopter in the air, but it was peaceful. Nothing happened last night. Nobody injured, nobody captured. Until now, we didn't hear anyone captured or injured. No gunfire from the force for 2 days.
What about earlier in the week? Was there gunfire? Were there shots fired on protesters?
Tonight, last night was the protester was in King Abdulaziz in street in the downtown of Kabif, and it was more than 500 women and men, and they call for peaceful demonstration, and they call it Silmiya. Silmiya means peaceful all the time, and they demand for freedom and free or release the prisoners in Saudi jails from more than 16 years without trial. And also the families of the prisoners are there. And in the end of the protester, they start have from the force, the police force, shot the gun and round bomb for to the protesters, two injured. I know their names, and they said three, but I saw two injured, minor injured in the thigh and in the shoulder.
Now, can you explain a little bit more about the issue with the prisoners? You said some prisoners have been in prison for 16 years without trial. Who are the people being imprisoned? Is it mostly Shiite Saudis? What are the reasons that they're being imprisoned for? Are they? Is it a sort of a political imprisonment, or is there another reason?
Yeah. In Kabif, you know, the most popular are Shiite. Of course, they are asking for free the prisoner, Shia prisoners that from 16 years, from 1906. But, you know, in Saudi, there is a lot of prisoners, political prisoners, more than 1,000 without trial until now. They are not only Shia or Sunni, they are from all over the country. Suppose this day, they call it the rage, day of rage, but until now we didn't have any information about other cities. But we heard in Al Hasa also today afternoon, that was a big demonstration. And the police attacked the protesters, and they captured 20 from them, and they took to prison.
So that's the southern city of Al-Ahsa. The Washington Post here in the United States is also reporting that that happened, that there were hundreds of protesters in that city, and several were arrested, and there was no violence. It was a very peaceful protest.
Yes, that earlier, that at 1 o'clock before the Kabif and what happened here.
Now, you mentioned that there are men and women protesting together. Saudi Arabia is a country that has some of the worst repression, state repression of women in terms of laws governing what women can and can't do. Do women take a bigger risk than men in protesting? And are there many Saudi men who feel solidarity with women?
Here in Kabif, because they are the family, sisters and mothers and daughters of the prisoners, and they brought the prisoners' pictures, and they raised it up, and also they brought flowers with the pictures last night. That happened last night. When the fires and the gun from the force against protesters. But if you say so, that we know that what happened here in Saudi Arabia. For that, all the young people now, they are demanding for more rights and more free to speech and a lot of change. And our people here, the publicity, more than 70 of them, they are young.
70%?
yes, 70% below than 25 years, and they all have then knowledge and information for lots of things happening all over the world.
So there's a growing awareness of the rights that they don't have because they see it. They're more connected with the global world.
That's right. And also, I know a lot of the religious leaders here, also in Qatif or in all the country, they forbidden the demonstration. Even here in Qatif, the leaders also said nobody go forbidden the demonstration for today. They said not for today, don't the protest for today. But the young generation, they are now more than take that to guarantee that word from the religious. For that, I think the demand is spread all over the country. And it's not about changing only for money or for jobs, or that's okay, but the demand, the real demand, is about their rights.
What about changing the democratic or changing the structure of the government structure of the country to actually be more democratic? Because there is no elected body in Saudi Arabia. It is essentially an absolute monarchy. Do people want the monarchy to give them more rights, or do they want to be able to vote in elections and elect their own bodies?
There is a lot of demanding for many years ago, but in the last two weeks, there is demanding of letters come from the intellectual, come from the youth, come from the, and sent to the king to different goals. Some of it to constitution of monarchy, some of elections in different levels, some of free to speech, some of release the prisoners, there is a lot of demand in the same letter one. And I think more than five letters sent to the king when he came from outside.
Are you talking about petitions that people would sign together?
A lot of and different people from everywhere and every, I mean, even from Shia, Sunna, even from liberal and religious, they all sign the different letters.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the responsibility of the United States as a Saudi? Do you see the U.S.'s relationship with Saudi Arabia and propping up the regime, in buying Saudi oil and enriching the Saudi monarchy? Do you see the United States government as bearing responsibility for the monarchy's strength?
I think, yes, everyone here in the Arab world, they saw the double standard, how to deal and treat country. But we know that depend on economical and political issues, not anything else. But frankly speaking, the hard what happened here in Saudi, that all the money of or more than 60% from the money of that coming from petrol,
from the oil sales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the oil, so to build the army and the force, and I think that means we have here a very strong force, and I hope not to see it against the people.
I'm speaking with Ahmed Al-Mullah. He is a writer and poet based in Saudi Arabia, joining us live from Qatif, which is a city in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia where there have been demonstrations. Today was designated a day of rage. Now, so you mentioned 60% of the oil sales from the U.S. Go towards building up the army in Saudi Arabia and the military forces. How risky is it for people to speak out? What risk do you personally take from giving interviews, from speaking out? And have you ever been arrested or been contacted by the authorities?
No, I didn't been arrested, but I think now is the time to speak and to say the right words in the right time. I think now it's all over the Arab countries, a lot of rage and call for freedom and change. I think we are part of that. We are not isolated anymore. We have to say it loud and frankly.
Well, Ahmed Al-Mullah, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Ahmed Al-Mullah is a writer and poet based in Saudi Arabia. And we've been talking about the Saudi activism that is part of the revolutionary fever spreading across the Arab world. We're going to take a short break. Later in the hour, we will look at the fight against the death penalty, which is gaining momentum. Illinois has become the 16th state now in the U.S. to abolish the death penalty. We'll also hear this week's Rethink Reviews with Jonathan Kim. And we'll look at a new bill that just passed the Senate in Michigan, the state Senate in Michigan, that some say sounds even worse than what's happened in Wisconsin. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Michael Slate, host of The Michael Slate Show here on KPFK every Friday morning at 10 a.m. If you're like me and think that there must be a better way of life than under this system, then join me every Friday as we explore everything from politics and world affairs to philosophy, art, music, and science. We'll take you from the halls of the universities to the streets of the cities. We'll also dig into all the expressions of resistance against this system and all the critical questions confronting us. We'll talk with some of the most insightful and often most radical voices on radio. And we'll do all of this in a search for truth so that together we can know the world to change the world. So if you think that there just might be a whole other way we could be and should be living, then tune in to The Michael Slate Show every Friday morning at 10 a.m. right here on KPFK.
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
Legislation approved Wednesday by the Michigan State Senate is being called worse than the anti-union legislation coming out of Wisconsin. The Michigan bill, referred to as the Emergency Managers Law, greatly expands the powers of emergency financial managers. The law would allow the state to strip a city government or school board of its power if the governor declares a financial emergency in the targeted municipality. A state-appointed emergency financial manager would then be given broad powers in pursuance of a balanced budget to terminate union contracts, seize and sell assets, and fire elected officials. Labor unions are calling it a union-busting bill. Many are voicing concern that it renders the right to vote and the democratic process null and void, with no public input on who is appointed manager or how the manager will operate once in place. Later, we'll speak with Michigan State AFL-CIO President Mark Gaffney about it. But now we're joined live on the phone by Gretchen Whitmer. She's a state senator from East Lansing in Michigan. In fact, she's the Senate Minority Leader. Welcome to Uprising, Ms. Whitmer.
Thank you, Sonali. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, Amy Goodman interviewed Naomi Klein yesterday, and Naomi Klein called this bill a corporate coup d'etat. Is that something, is that accurate?
Well, I think so. You know, we have avoided a showdown on the front lawn like they've had in Wisconsin. But what we see here is where Governor Walker went through the front door. Governor Snyder in Michigan is sneaking in the back, and it's all about undoing bargaining rights and hurting working families.
Now, what exactly would constitute an emergency financial emergency, and are there cities in Michigan currently where there are unaccountable or rather appointed financial managers already operating?
There are. They currently do operate in a few cities and in Detroit Public Schools, for instance. And that emergency financial manager is someone who is just handpicked by the treasurer, has enormous authority to go in and undo contracts, sell off assets, And he's making almost $400,000 a year. There's no accountability or transparency. So this is an enormous amount of power that these people are given. And with the budget that Governor Snyder has introduced in Michigan, there are over 100 communities and 160 school districts that will likely be in line for emergency financial management as a result of those cuts. And so not only have they forced the crisis, they've changed the rules of how we're supposed to operate to get our way out of it.
Hmm. Now, who declares or who decides by what measure a municipality is in financial crisis?
Well, it's, you know, it varies. There, like, for instance, in the school, in the Detroit public schools, they had a history of not meeting certain criteria that are placed specifically for the school district. So it's a little bit, fluctuates a little bit depending on what kind of governmental authority it is. But, not failing to make your budget, continuing to, default on payments, those are instances where, these municipalities or schools would fall into emergency financial management.
Now, I understand that several amendments were proposed, one of them to cap emergency managers' salaries. That one failed, even though this is apparently about balancing budgets and saving money. But apparently you can't pay an appointed financial emergency manager too much. There was also a particular amendment that would have allowed for public meetings for managers, having some kind of public input, and also having school board managers with education experience as a requirement. These are all common sense amendments. How did they fail?
Well, they all went down on party line votes, and it was kind of the one of the comments that I made was we've just exploded bureaucracy and giving, enormous amounts of money to someone who's unaccountable and there's no transparency. So I said, where the heck is the Tea Party now? Isn't this the antithesis of what the voters said they wanted with this last election? And here we see this huge government expansion, and it's going to cost the taxpayers so much money without any guarantees that it's going to help a district or help a city. And we couldn't even get them to say, okay, we should make sure that they are subject to conflict of interest rules that apply to everybody else. We couldn't even get that amendment on. It was a party line fight.
It seems as though the Tea Party is only interested when ordinary people, public employees, unions are the ones who are in, who are doing the work or getting paid to do the work, who have decent benefits. But if it's somebody with a profit interest, somebody with, either a corporate entity or an individual with a profit interest, that doesn't fall into the category of an unaccountable bureaucracy.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that statement, and what we're seeing in these debates from the Republican governor's office to my Republican colleagues who are in the majorities in both chambers in Michigan is that they do talk a lot about cutting state employees. They're happy to debate the human services worker who's balancing 7,000 cases of kids in our state to debate their $45,000 a year salary, but yet go ahead and give $500,000 to an emergency manager who's completely unaccountable and doesn't have any standards that they have to meet.
Finally, Senator Whitmer, do you feel that the Republicans, from Wisconsin to Michigan to Ohio and to many other states where we're seeing these bills that seem to have one thing in common, which is break the unions, are they going to face serious political payback?
I think so. I think when people see that what appears to be a new mindset is actually just the same old playbook, that it will have a backlash on them. A lot of these people got elected saying they supported smaller government, and what they're doing is they're creating a larger government, and they're using taxpayers to pad the bottom line of corporations. And I think when people really understand it and see what it's doing to their schools and to their communities, that they will be enraged.
Well, Senator Gretchen Whitmer, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Gretchen Whitmer is a state senator from East Lansing, Michigan. She's a Senate minority leader there, and Michigan is the state that whose Senate just passed this emergency manager's law. We turn now to Michigan State AFL-CIO President Mark Gaffney, who I spoke with earlier this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Mark Gaffney.
Thank you.
So this particular legislation seems to be hinged on, the emergency law legislation seems to be hinged on the Republicans' desire to break unions. Can it be boiled down to that?
Well, the emergency financial manager legislation has a lot of components. One of the components is to throw out the collective bargaining agreement and impose terms that the workers would work under. It also allows complete privatization of current workers' work. Those decisions would be made by one person, only one person, not subject to city council or the school board review, and that one person is appointed by our state treasurer. And so it's just far too much power, and that power includes ending collective bargaining rights.
Now, the governor had said that there are too many municipalities loaded with debt that are paying out salaries or benefits that are out of sync with the private sector, and yet an amendment that would have capped the salary of this appointed emergency manager at $159,000 failed. How did that happen?
Well, it failed because the Republicans do not want anything to tie their hands. The House Republicans, when they wrote their version of the bill, would have allowed this financial manager to be a firm, a law firm. And so you can imagine how expensive that would have been. But look, at the same time the Republicans are saying we need extraordinary, really dictatorial powers for emergency managers, they are backing the governor's budget, which takes away one-third of what we call state revenue sharing, millions of dollars from cities, and reduces K-12 education funding by over $400 each student. So when the governor says we have cities and school districts in financial difficulties, he is adding to the problem with his budget. We could end up with 100 to 200 municipalities and school districts under these extraordinary dictators, financial managers, and if you just average each of those with 500 employees, 50,000 Michigan union members will be at risk of losing their collective bargaining rights and their contract.
So it's on
and their jobs.
So it sounds as though Republican state senators and their governor and the governor are helping to create a crisis that they can then use to break unions.
Well, this is, of course, the pattern. And the folks in the know on the left of the political spectrum have been talking about this for a little while. We really hope that all citizens, all voters begin to understand what is happening here. I might refer you to a book called Shock Capitalism. The author is Naomi Klein.
The Shock Doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, Shock Doctrine. Thank you. And she lays out quite clearly what this is. You take advantage of a crisis, either in a city or, in fact, in her book, she talks about entire countries. And then you put on rules that make the crisis worse. For countries, this is done by the International Monetary Fund. For Michigan cities, this is done, as we're speaking, by the governor and the legislature. And then you design really draconian solutions or methods to solve the problem that you in part caused. And those solutions, guess what? Not by coincidence, lead to privatization, more money for businesses. It's paid for by the workers and the average people. It carries on the transfer of wealth in this country, and again in Ms. Klein's book, examples of other countries, where the middle class has been decimated and the wealthy class and the corporations get the benefit of solving these crises. And by the way, I think that's what's going on across this country, not only in Michigan.
Do you think that what's happening in Michigan, this particular bill that has passed the state Senate now and looks likely to pass, is actually worse than the bill that was passed, the anti-union bill that was passed in Wisconsin that garnered so much national attention?
Well, it's not worse. Here's what we say in Michigan. We have Wisconsin on the installment plan. Wisconsin took collective bargaining rights away from three or four times the number of workers that these financial manager bills can potentially do. Wisconsin did it all at once. It would take us two or three years to reach that possible number of about 50,000. So Wisconsin clearly is the worst location in our country for public sector workers, for Republicans with extreme measures. But in state after state, unfortunately, including my state, we're seeing parts of Wisconsin, we're seeing pieces of Wisconsin, we're seeing plays out of the same playbook.
Now, what about the level of organizing and protest in Michigan? Has it been effective? Are people, you know, was this bill rammed through so fast that people haven't had a chance to organize?
Well, no, not really. We will have our third rally at the Capitol on Wednesday coming up, Wednesday of next week. Each time we've done this, the crowd grows. We have committees back in the districts of 44 Republican House and Senate members, and we're trying to get these people to understand that their constituents, union and non-union, don't want them to act like Tea Party extremists. Michigan has a history of politics that's largely in the center. When there have been Republican governors, they have governed from the center right. When there has been Democratic governors in Michigan, they've governed from the center left. This is the first time our politics have become quite this extreme. And of course, it's part of what you're seeing all across the country. So our members, and by the way, regular citizens, AARP, Association of Retired People, will have a rally themselves on Tuesday, and ours is on Wednesday. So Michigan citizens are waking up to this. I think they're just surprised, frankly.
Now, what about President Obama, who was elected as an ally of unions? Many unions across the country and union members worked very hard during his campaign to elect him. And, you know, it seems as though over the past couple of years, he hasn't turned out to be as much of an ally as labor, organized labor would hope. He has been not very vocal at all on these attacks that we're seeing in various states. Whether he has the power to do anything about it or not, he certainly has the ability to verbalize, which he doesn't seem to be using.
Well, we call it the bully pulpit, don't we? And
yeah.
My advice, if President Obama were to ask it, would be to read Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, and call his economic advisors in and say, show me the proofs that this transfer of wealth from the middle class to the wealthy, from unions to corporations, show me the proof that this is happening. And by golly, there would be proof after proof, statistics after statistics, that show it. The Wall Street Journal itself said that in the years 09 and 2010, years of recession, business profits increased 30%, while wages increased 2%. Now, that's a continuation of a transfer of wealth, even in bad times. So the president, I think, understands that. He probably needs to spend more time thinking about it and thinking about what his response would be. Because, by the way, if the Republicans get away with this in a dozen states, if they complete their, what I call their lurch to the right. And if these policies of decimating collective bargaining, taking the power, including power to speak at election time, power to engage in politics, taking that power away from public sector unions, the president's country is going to end up in a place where I'm convinced he would not want it to be. So is it time for him to take a hard look at this? Absolutely, yes. Would we welcome any comments and statements about what's going on from him? Absolutely, yes.
Well, Mark Gaffney, I wish you the best of luck. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for reaching out across the entire country to hear from Michigan.
Mark Gaffney is the Michigan State AFL-CIO president. We also heard from Gretchen Whitmer, state senator from East Lansing, Michigan, and the Senate minority leader. We've been talking about the Michigan Emergency Finance Law Bill, which just passed the state Senate, expected to be signed into law after the House and after the Assembly and the Senate bills are reconciled. This is Uprising, and after this week's Rethink Reviews, we'll go to Illinois to take a look at how the death penalty was finally abolished after 11 years of debate and commission. Stay tuned.
Hey! I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is Rethink Reviews, where we take a deeper look at current and past films and how they relate to the world today.
You didn't eat your broccoli.
Broccoli makes me barf. Besides, it looks like brains.
Well, you like zombies. Zombies eat brains.
Mom, no one likes zombies. They're an abomination. I'm committed to their annihilation.
Okay. Well, no broccoli, no TV.
The new CG 3D animated film Mars Needs Moms is based on a children's book by Berkeley Breathitt, who some of you may know as the creator of the beloved Bloom County comic strip. Unfortunately, one of the producers of Mars Needs Moms is Robert Zemeckis, whose previous work includes making a highly profitable mess out of the beloved children's book The Polar Express, which used nascent performance capture technology that created characters with dead eyes and mask-like faces, and bloated an elegant story to feature length with noisy, pointless action. While the technology has clearly improved, Mars Needs Moms suffers from the same flaws, but the film does make some interesting observations about parenting here on Earth. In the film, an authoritarian, matriarchal Martian society is desperate to find Earthling moms with good parenting skills to use as templates to program the army of nanny bots that raise their young. Milo, a 9-year-old performed by Seth Green, has such a mom, though he bristles under her authority, even telling her in a moment of anger that he wished he never had a mom. But when Milo's wish is granted and his mom is kidnapped by Martians, Milo travels to Mars to bring her back.
My name is Gribble. Gribble the First. What's your handle? Oh, wait, let me guess. Maverick.
No.
Wolfman?
Iceman.
No. Did you see Top Gun?
Unfortunately, this means teaming up with an irritating human named Gribble, performed by Dan Fogler, who grew up in Mars's trash dump, and a sympathetic Martian named Key, performed by Elizabeth Arnois, who's been inspired by a 60s-era TV show to speak in hippie slang and promote flower power, which is about as annoying as you'd imagine. But what about the film's view on parenting? Milo's dad, who you only see briefly, travels for work and is apparently the one who takes Milo on fun outings, leaving Milo's mom, performed by Joan Cusack, in the unenviable and tiring role of disciplinarian and taskmaster. A recognition that it's usually moms who do the difficult, unglamorous job of day-to-day parenting, while many dads just show up for playtime.
I thought I told you to go to bed.
You told me to go to bed. You didn't say get into bed. It's not specific.
Milo!
This dynamic is taken to an extreme on Mars, which is ruled by a decrepit female dictator known simply as the Supervisor, who forbids fun, emotion, and color, while male Martians are sent to the planet's trash heap and deemed worthless for only wanting to, quote, dance and play. Milo's true journey isn't to the red planet and back, but to learn to appreciate the often thankless work of being a good parent. And that, unlike the supervisor, his mom's discipline comes out of love. And nowhere is a mother's love better illustrated than in a beautiful and wordless moment late in the film that, I'll admit, got me pretty choked up. But this instance of authentic emotion is one of the only bright spots in an otherwise soulless, charmless effort that seems to say that you should be nice to your mom lest she be kidnapped and destroyed. If it takes an alien abduction to get a kid to take out the garbage, moms are in more trouble than we thought. Mars Needs Moms is rated PG and is in theaters now. I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is a Rethink Review for Uprising.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On Wednesday, Illinois became the 16th state to abolish the death penalty. In a private ceremony, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn signed a bill which had been sent to him by the state legislature in January. Quinn said the decision was the most difficult of his tenure. A moratorium on the death penalty had been declared in 2000 by then-Illinois Governor George Ryan. Over the past 11 years, the state has employed two commissions to create safeguards that would ensure no innocent person lands on death row. No reforms were found that were foolproof and cost-effective. Quinn said that after careful review and consideration of the evidence, the possibility of killing an innocent person was too much to risk. He said what's really in question is the system itself. If the system cannot be guaranteed to be 100% error-free, then we shouldn't have the system. It is just not right in our democracy and system of justice. The governor's decision is a reversal from his position as a candidate when he voiced support for capital punishment. This has angered some victim and death penalty advocates who saw him as an ally. Republican State Senator Bill Brady said by signing this legislation, Governor Quinn has once again misled the citizens of Illinois and acted contrary to the principles and promises he stood for during his campaign. Quinn also commuted the sentences of all 15 inmates on Illinois' death row to life in prison without parole. My guests are Jeremy Schroeder, Executive Director of the Illinois Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and Stephanie Forche. She is the Associate Director of Death Penalty Focus. Welcome to Uprising, Jeremy and Stephanie.
Morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jeremy, I'd like to start with you. I mentioned it's been 11 years. Over these 11 years, what exactly has happened aside from these commissions that have been appointed from up high? What role has grassroots organizing and mobilizing played in this moment that we're now at in Illinois?
Oh, it's played a huge role. I mean, besides the commissions, which, you know, we've had our best and brightest here in Illinois looking at ways to, you know, quote unquote, fix the death penalty. You know, and after a decade, you know, we have, you know, evidence that, you know, the death penalty can't be fixed. And while it was all going on, we were trying to making sure that the public got that information, that they understood that we had put in place reforms. There were still problems with the death penalty. We were still finding innocent people on death row. And it really started to open people's eyes. And what led to this moment was just getting out to each and every community, letting them know that the system was still broken and we were still, you know, wasting money on it.
And Jeremy, what exactly do you think it was that changed Governor Pat Quinn's mind from going against statements that he had made or positions he had taken as he was campaigning?
Well, I think it's just a lot of he kind of reflects the kind of general atmosphere here in Illinois. I think there's a lot of people that when you talk about being for or against the death penalty, they think about a death penalty for bad people in an arbitrary kind of way. But here in Illinois, we have a very real, you know, tie to the death penalty. With 20 innocent people found on death row, you know, most people would say that's a broken system and that's something that we need to do without. With Governor Quinn, you know, you look at, you know, first and foremost, our horrible history of finding innocent people on death row, and then you kind of dive into it a little bit more and with to the Illinois death penalty, and you find out that it's harmful to murder victims' families with the moratorium going on, and even if we did not have a moratorium, just the length of time that death penalty cases take, that's time that, you know, we have to have to make sure that we are, you know, going through and have all parts of evidence are heard, but that's also time that the families are waiting for some sort of just to find out what happens in their case. Mm. And all of that costs money, and especially Illinois is so broke right now that it's amazing that we've had this much kind of talk about a system that's so so expensive and so obviously broken.
Stephanie, Illinois has become the 16th state to abolish the death penalty. What are some of the other states and have, you know, have these bans that we're seeing taking place? Do they point to building a momentum towards a nationwide ban?
Absolutely. What we're seeing is a bipartisan trend that's sweeping the country where states are reevaluating the death penalty for the first time because of many of the issues that Jeremy mentioned. Because of the high cost, the death penalty is literally bankrupting many counties and many states. And also because of the problem of wrongful conviction that we've discovered, innocent people are landing on death row. So states like Montana and Connecticut and Maryland and Washington and Florida are all introducing bills to abolish the death penalty. And in the past few years, we've seen New Jersey, New Mexico, and New York abolish the death penalty. this is a nationwide trend, and I believe it will continue, and it will reach California.
Well, tell us what the status is of California right now, because there certainly had been some movements in the direction of banning the death penalty here.
Public opinion in California is definitely shifting on this issue. A majority of voters in California certainly prefer life without the possibility of parole as an alternative to the death penalty as a punishment for first-degree murder. In California, though, we have a very unique situation because the voters will have to decide ultimately about whether to abolish the death penalty or not, because back in 1978, it was the voters who reintroduced the death penalty in California. So we believe that the voters will eventually do this in California when they're ready, and that time may be sooner than we think.
Hmm. And Jeremy Schroeder, the law becomes effective this July in Illinois, but even though the governor has commuted the life sentences of the existing inmates on death row, is it true that prosecutors can still seek the death penalty until this July?
It is technically true, but the governor has stated he will commute the sentences of anyone convicted during that time. And what we're also seeing is that judges as well as prosecutors and other attorneys on the case are just not going after the death penalty. It just doesn't make any sense at this point.
And is it true that since 2000, since George Ryan put the moratorium in place, there has not been a single death state execution in Illinois?
That's correct.
And what does this mean now for folks like yourself? Is the battle, essentially, is the war now over for the coalition to abolish the death penalty?
Somewhat, but I think we have to remain vigilant. It's something that the death penalty has unfortunately become a very political issue, that every time there is a horrible crime, instead of turning to systems to prevent crime, many times those running for office turn to the death penalty. And it's really an easy but unfortunately expensive and, you know, uninformed solution. So we need to be, you know, here in some form making sure that any bill to bring back the death penalty is brought up and we show that, you know, the reasons that it shouldn't be here.
Well, are there such efforts? What is the opposition? I quoted one Republican state senator, Bill Brady, and apparently there are some victims advocates group and pro-death penalty groups in Illinois that are quite upset about this, but are they in the minority?
They definitely are in the minority. The governor has already said, you know, he's very much in support of the abolition of the death penalty, and any bills coming forward will be, you know, taken care of. Besides that, I mean, I think that the folks that are getting very vocal are also the same people that ran against this governor in the last election. So, I mean, it's kind of suspect that all of the bills going forward are by people that will be, you know, we will see again in the election. One other thing that our bill does that I think has gained us a lot of credibility and also new allies, it takes the money that we have been wasting on the death penalty and sets up a fund for murder victims' family members as well as training for police officers. So we really thought that it makes the most sense. Instead of, if we have a system that doesn't work, let's take that money and put it towards something that does, preventing crime and making sure that our murder victims' families have services that they need.
Stephanie Forche, what can be learned from the model, from what's happening in Illinois? Is it possible to try to apply some of the lessons learned in Illinois to here in California, or is the ballot the only way to go?
Well, the ballot is the only way to go here in California, but I think there are many lessons to be learned. Certainly what Illinois learned over the past 10 years is that they studied the system, they identified reforms, they implemented some of those reforms, and they found out that the system couldn't be fixed. I think this is something that we should take to heart. We've tried to implement reforms here in California to no avail. Many reforms similar to those in Illinois were passed by the legislature in the past few years and were vetoed by Governor Schwarzenegger.
But we have a new governor now.
We have a new governor now, so we have hope that there will be some reforms implemented. But what we learned in Illinois is those reforms weren't enough. They weren't able to fix a completely broken system that, as Jeremy mentioned, dragged victims through years of waiting, endless waiting, that costed a huge amount of money. And in California, the death penalty costs taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars each year. It will cost the state $1 billion over the next 5 years to maintain the death penalty. This is resources, as Jeremy said, that we could be directing towards victim services, towards law enforcement, towards programs that will actually make our communities safer. We have a very high rate of unsolved homicides in California, particularly in Los Angeles County, and it's very important that we start focusing our limited resources on the programs that work, and the death penalty just isn't one of those programs at this point.
And Stephanie, how do you view the nationwide trend towards abolishing the death penalty, looking at this as a movement that is only growing and gaining momentum? You know, so many other issues in the country seem to be going towards a very regressive trend. There's so much fear. You know, we've looked at these congressional hearings held by Representative Peter King about the radicalization of Muslims in this country. It seems as though we're in a moment in so many other aspects where people are acting out of fear and lashing out and scapegoating at the vulnerable. And yet on the death penalty issue, there is progressive change. What is that? How do you explain that?
Well, I think what's been really important in Illinois and in other states that are considering abolition of the death penalty is that it's a bipartisan effort. Republicans and Democrats are working together because they realize that the death penalty is a policy that we simply can't afford anymore.
So is it just purely financial? I mean, but if it were, Republicans would get smart on other issues that were purely financial, too. You know, just I'm not quite getting why Republicans get it on this issue but not others.
Well, the financial issue is a very important one, but it's certainly not the only issue. We know that law enforcement needs more money right now, that victims' families are not being served by this system, that the system is risking the execution of innocent people. And we can universally agree that innocent people should not be executed. We're finding common ground and realizing that this is a system that fails everyone. And
now, it's not like the death penalty abolition activism has gotten any help from the pro-life part of the conservative movement, has it?
Well, certainly the Catholic Church has been very vocal in expressing opposition to the death penalty because of their belief in the sanctity of life.
And that has been one institution that has been an exception, that has been more consistent on their positions. Yeah.
Absolutely. They have been very consistent and very clear that the Catholic Church does not support the death penalty for a variety of reasons. And what we're seeing is really part of a global trend. Three countries a year abolish the death penalty. The death penalty will be abolished in this country. It is inevitable. It's only a matter of time and which state will be next. And as I said, there are so many states this year that are moving in that direction. I think that we could see a few other states this year abolish the death penalty.
Well, finally, Jeremy Schroeder, back to you in Illinois. Give out a website for your organization so that listeners can see the work that your group has been doing and, you know, just get a sense of the activism that it has taken from the grassroots to make all of this happen as well.
Oh, certainly. Our website is www.icadp.org, and we're also on Facebook as well, so that might be the more fun one to see right now.
icadp.org, and what do they search for on Facebook, just those initials?
The Illinois Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty.
And we'll find that and post it to our website, uprisingradio.org, later today as well. Stephanie Fauché, what about death penalty focus, and how can listeners here in California get involved?
Well, there are so many ways to get involved. You can visit our website, which is deathpenalty.org. Again, that's deathpenalty.org. We're also on Facebook. You can look for Death Penalty Focus. And we have an action right now where you can thank Governor Quinn for his courage in doing what was right on our website. And you can also send Governor Jerry Brown a letter telling him that you think he should follow Governor Quinn's lead and commute the death sentences of the more than 700 people on California's death row to life without the possibility of parole, so that we can save $1 billion over the next 5 years.
And is there a way for them to also join Death Penalty Focus as an activist in the larger struggle to get this issue to the ballot when the time is right?
Absolutely. You can sign up on our website, deathpenalty.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at Death Penalty Focus or DP Focus on Twitter. And we encourage people to get involved. There's a lot to do here, and Governor Brown needs to hear from voters of the state.
Well, Stephanie Fauché, Jeremy Schroeder, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much.
Stephanie Fauché is the Associate Director of Death Penalty Focus here in California. Jeremy Schroeder, the Executive Director of the Illinois Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, H. Jackson Brown once said, "In the confrontation between the stream and the rock, the stream always wins, not through strength, but perseverance. That's Anali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. You can find us at facebook.com/uprisingradio or at twitter.com/uprisingradio or simply at uprisingradio.org. Drop us an email at mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. See you Monday at 8.